Dr. Martin's thesis is that there is a anti-black invective which runs through the sacred rabbinic literature of Judaism. That is not to say that it runs through the literature of the Bible, because there is a distinction between the Hebrew literature and the rabbinic literature. There have been, since Dr. Martin's speech, two major texts which have been issued by Judaic scholars. Jonathan Schorsch is professor at Columbia University and the author of a book entitled Jews and Blacks in the Early Modern World. Notorious anti-black racist in Judaism, just happens to be Judaism's most influential and revered sage, Rabbi Moses Maimonides, who taught in his book, The Guide of the Perplexed, that blacks are subhuman. Now, Schorsch has written 546 pages on the relationship of Jews and blacks. One would think that he would be able to explicate Maimonides' teaching about black people at length, since it forms the heart of Judaism's attitude towards blacks. However, since Maimonides is indefensible, Schorsch dares not. Hence, like any propagandist, the Columbia University professor buries the inconvenient Maimonides in his footnotes, where we find the offending statement quoted in small type with no comment or exegesis of any kind, as if it were the doctrine of some long-ago forgotten village Rebbe, instead of the major halakhic authority in Judaism. Neither can Professor Schorsch bring himself to quote the Talmudic and Midrashic accounts of the curse on Ham, which form the canonical Judaic understanding about black people. By shying away from a confrontation with these texts, he does little to dispel the critique of Tony Martin and others. Professor Martin quotes these anti-black rabbinic teachings during the speech which you are about to see. How can Schorsch claim to debunk the Martins of the world when he can't even bring himself to confront the problem sacred Judaic texts? Book that the Talmud's creators, first of all, were lawyers. And Neusner went on to say, again, I remind you, we are in the hands of lawyers. Let's observe lawyer Schorsch in action. Jews and Blacks in the Early Modern World, page 139. Seeing a Jewish curse of Ham behind every English notion of black accursedness will not do. If one looks carefully, the explicit citation of Jewish authors remains extremely rare in early modern writings. Some, of course, did indeed cite Jewish authorities. But overall, the curse of Ham seems to comprise a case of intra-Christian discursive influence. The Jewish Bible, having been claimed as a Christian text already long before the medieval period, early modern Christian authorities continued to make use of it as a component of the Christian canon. And that's a quote from Jews and Blacks in the Early Modern World by Jonathan Schorsch, published by the Cambridge University Press. Well, nice try, Professor Schorsch. But the fact is, the Israelite Bible was misappropriated by the rabbis, not the Christians, who are its rightful heirs. Furthermore, Schorsch misleads readers into thinking that it is the biblical teaching about blacks that is the pivot of anti-black racism in the West, when Schorsch knows very well that the anti-black rabbinic dogma is diametrically opposed to the Old Testament. Therefore, citing the Old Testament in a racial context as the curse of Ham's, quote, intra-Christian discursive influence is nothing more than a lawyer's trick with a $50 phrase. The mendacious chutzpah represented by this outrageous dissembling is truly audacious. Such a gambit can only be sustained before an audience almost totally ignorant of the relevant foundational rabbinic texts. The curse of Ham, as taught by the rabbis, is what Abraham Melamed rightly terms the locus classicus of Judaism's historic antipathy toward black people and the exegetical source of its racist teaching from the Amorim of Babylonia to Moses Maimonides. The dogma that the black is a slave by nature is rabbinic in origin. Canaan is identified as a black man, and blacks as an inferior people, only in the Gemara, which is to say the latter part of the Talmud, the Midrash, and later writings of the rabbis. This invective, this racism, is not anywhere in the Bible concerning the black race. The rabbinic account of the malediction against Ham stipulates that Ham's son Canaan and all Canaan's issue are forever fated to suffer perpetual slavery and black skin, without the possibility of their condition ever being ameliorated. It is this anti-Old Testament rabbinic gloss that influenced those 15th century Renaissance humanists who had crossed over into the forbidden territory of the Talmud, Midrash, and Kabbalah as part of a supposedly enlightened act. It is an irony of history that as a result of this supposedly progressive development, the abominable view of black people as a congenitally determined race of perpetual slaves became entrenched among the Western liberal intelligentsia for at least the next 300 years. Here's what Schorsch writes in his book, Jews and Blacks in the Early Modern World. Few Jewish thinkers understood Ham's curse to initiate his or her progeny's blackness. That is an out-and-out prevarication. The classic rabbinic texts hold that the punishment visited upon Ham was the transformation of his son Canaan and all Canaan's progeny into blacks. Rabbi Hiyah said, Ham and the dog copulated on the ark, therefore Ham came forth dark-skinned. That is the canonical rabbinic teaching of Orthodox Judaism. And Schorsch's book covers this up, and yet Schorsch's book has become the paradigmatic text for those in university and college level training in this subject to refer to when they are seeking out information on this subject. And there is a second book which has come along to supplement Schorsch's. This book is by David Goldenberg. David Goldenberg is the author of a book entitled The Curse of Ham. And this book has received even more lavish encomiums than Schorsch's book. Both of these books together have formed the ultimate bulwark against the research and scholarship of people like Dr. Tony Martin. However, of course, Dr. Martin is never allowed or invited to debate these two supposed authorities on this subject for obvious reasons. Now, Goldenberg's thesis in The Curse of Ham is just as outrageous as Schorsch's and just as dissembling. He claims that among Jewish writers in the Christian West, we begin to see a curse of Ham mentioned in the same time that Christian writers mention it. And he cites an obscure text, Moses Aragel's 15th century Castilian commentary to the Bible. There is no mention of Maimonides or his text, The Guide of the Perplexed, in David M. Goldenberg's supposedly exhaustive encyclopedic study of the Judaic relationship with black people entitled The Curse of Ham. And so with that background, I present to you Professor Tony Martin, The Judaic Role in the Black Slave Trade.
The notion of real history, which is the notion, as far as I gather, that sort of pervades this conference. History, as I think everyone here will recognize, is perhaps the most contentious of all subjects. But the fact that history is a contentious subject, subject to varying interpretations, is no reason, I believe, to justify the effort which has become somewhat widespread in recent years to attempt to criminalize dissenting historical opinions. to either criminalize those opinions literally, or sometimes to subject those who hold differing opinions to widespread vilification. So I endorse the notion then of real history. History is controversial, it is contentious, but differences of opinion, I think, in the historical profession ought to be debated, ought to be fought out in the broad arena of ideas, and hopefully in time, the correct ideas will prevail, hopefully, and incorrect ideas will die. The topic which I hope to deal with today is the recent controversies surrounding the question of the African slave trade, that is the slave trade in African people across the Atlantic Ocean. So that's the controversies which have arisen surrounding that question of the transatlantic slave trade. Slavery, as we know, has been historically an almost universal institution. I suspect that there must be very, very few societies that have not, at one time or another, experienced slavery. Karl Marx argued that slavery was one of the basic stages that Western European society went through after what he called primitive communism and preceding feudalism and so on. As one looks around the world at other societies, one sees examples of slavery just about every place. Slavery in ancient Greece is very well known. There's a very famous quotation from the Roman politician and man of letters, Cicero, in which he wrote to some friend of his one time, suggesting to that friend that when he went to buy slaves, that he should avoid buying English slaves because they were so stupid, ignorant. He thought that a guy would be wasting his money. In fact, it's very fascinating because the kinds of stereotypes that Cicero was putting forward in relation to English slaves were not that different from the kinds of stereotypes that developed later on pertaining to African slaves. So slavery then has been a very universal experience. Nevertheless, it has been a very controversial experience, and it continues to be a very controversial experience. One of the very first controversies surrounding slavery is the question of defining slavery. What precisely is slavery? A variety of different types of human condition have been described over the years as slavery. For example, serfdom in Europe has been described on occasion as being slavery. Sometimes, when speaking of the African situation prior to the transatlantic slave trade, sometimes historians have used the expression domestic slavery to try to differentiate the kind of so-called slavery that existed on the African continent prior to the transatlantic slave trade with what eventually developed in the Americas and elsewhere. Domestic slavery is said to have been something akin to domestic servitude, where those who were slaves had a certain amount of social mobility and weren't necessarily subjected to the kind of harsh regime that developed in the Americas later on. We have the term slavery applied to what in some history books has come to be known as white slavery, the white slave trade. I believe it was 1910 in the United States of America when an act was passed against so-called white slavery, the Mann Act. I think it was 1910. And white slavery supposedly was a slave, not supposedly, it was a trade in women, many of whom apparently were Jewish women coming out of Central Europe, and a trade which, notwithstanding the fact that the women were Jews, a trade which apparently was prosecuted by Jewish entrepreneurs. It was a global trade in which apparently women were sent from Europe across the world to act as prostitutes and so on. This was in the 19th century and into the early 20th century as well. So the term slavery has been applied to that situation, so-called white slavery, the white slave trade. There are many other controversies concerning slavery at all different periods in history. For example, there's a controversy which is raging right now concerning whether Jews were enslaved in ancient Egypt. You know, there's been a body of thought over the years relying on biblical sources and whatnot, supposedly relying on biblical sources, suggesting that Jews were enslaved in ancient Egypt. There's another body of thought which argues that there's no real evidence for Jews having been enslaved in ancient Egypt. So that's another controversy which has arisen. There's a controversy concerning slave labor in Egypt, period, among indigenous ancient Egyptians. There's a body of thought that suggests that the pyramids of ancient Egypt were constructed by slave labor. There's a contrary body of thought which suggests that no, there was no slave labor. It was a question of peasants being used as construction workers at a time because of the inundation of the Nile Valley at a time when, you know, life was relatively slow, etc., etc. One of the biggest controversies concerning slavery arose in the context of the transatlantic slave trade on the question of the relationship between capitalism and slavery. In fact, that precise phrase was the title of one of the outstanding books on the slave trade, Capitalism and Slavery, a book written by Eric Williams, a man who subsequently became Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago. And Eric Williams argued that the rise of the capitalism in Europe and the Industrial Revolution, more precisely in England in the late 1700s, was a direct consequence, he argued, of the super profits, the unprecedented accumulation of capital that took place as a result of the transatlantic slave trade. Williams attempted to document this thesis in very, very minute detail. Nevertheless, this has remained an area of great controversy, perhaps one of the greatest areas of controversy around slavery and the slave trade. Was the slave trade the reason for the great accumulation of capital that made the Industrial Revolution possible in England and subsequently in the rest of Europe? Yet another of the great controversies that has arisen and that continues to rage around the question of slavery is the question of statistics pertaining to the African slave trade across the Atlantic. How many Africans perished in that slave trade? Estimates run anything from 8 or 9 million to 600 million. Black historians have tended to be on the, you know, the largest side of those estimates, and other historians have often tended to be on, you know, towards the more conservative estimates. I don't think anybody will ever know precisely how many people died. Suffice it to say that many died in Africa itself before they ever made it to a slave ship. Sometimes slaves were obtained as much as 1,000 miles inland from the shore. And it was a very arduous journey from wherever slaves were obtained, very often to the shore. Once they got to the shore areas, there sometimes was a period of waiting in harsh conditions, you know, while they awaited the arrival of a slave ship and so on. A conventional figure that we often see is that mortality across the Atlantic, that is during what they call the Middle Passage, the trip from West Africa to the Americas. It is said in many books that the mortality during that Middle Passage was something like 33%. This in itself, I'm sure, is a figure that's subject to some controversy. But it is suggested very often that maybe 1 in 3 of each of those Africans who was, you know, embarked on a ship, a slave ship, on the West African coast was dead before they even arrived in the Americas. C.L.R. James, the man who has written a definitive history of the Haitian Revolution, C.L.R. James says in his famous book, The Black Jacobins, that the life expectancy for an African slave arriving in Haiti was 6 years. So those African slaves who survived that 1,000 miles or maybe less journey from the interior of Africa to the coast, and who then survived that, those were the most hardy of the Africans, the ones who were able to survive that arduous experience. Once they got to Haiti, C.L.R. James suggests, they were dead, most of them within 6 years. The life expectancy was 6 years. He says that it was, from a purely economic perspective, it was better for the planters to work slaves literally to death in Haiti, literally to death, than import new ones, rather than, you know, keep them alive, treat them well, and then have to deal with diminishing returns as time went on, as they became older, as they became a charge on the plantation, as they were unable to work, etc. It is perhaps because of some of these controversies that the term chattel slavery has been advanced by some historians in relation to the kind of slavery that developed in the Americas. Because the term slavery has come to cover so many types of situations, some historians have used the term chattel slavery to describe slavery as it existed in our part of the world here in the Americas. Chattel, from the English word meaning chattel, as in cattle, indicating that human beings in this kind of slavery were treated like animals, like cattle, in a way that perhaps was not necessarily always present in slavery in other places. Perhaps that kind of debasement of the human spirit perhaps was not as prevalent perhaps in serfdom in Europe, or maybe in domestic slavery in Africa, etc. So the term chattel slavery then is one reflection of an effort to come to grips with at least one aspect of these many controversies concerning the slave trade. Another controversy pertains to the question of what kind of institution slavery was in the Americas. Was it a benign institution? Were the slaves happy? Did they cry when their master died? Did they bow and scrape? Did they become Sambo characters? Sambo is a term that some historians have come up with to describe a kind of personality whereby Africans supposedly acquiesce, I guess, in the institution of slavery. They like being subjected. They like being enslaved and so on. They became childlike, etc. So were they Sambos? Did they like slavery? Were they mostly rebellious? Was slavery a harsh institution? Was it a mild institution? All of these are areas around which controversy has raged. There's a historian back in the 1940s, a man called Tannenbaum, who put forward yet another controversial thesis. He argued that slavery was milder in the Portuguese and Spanish territories in the Americas than it was in the Protestant territories. He argued that the Portuguese in places like Brazil and the Spaniards in other places were prone to miscegenation, and as far as he was concerned, miscegenation was some kind of an indicator of madness. My own argument is that nothing could be further from the truth. Miscegenation simply meant that slave owners had access, sexual access, to their slave women and took advantage of that situation. But miscegenation outside of marriage is not, ipso facto and per se evidence of anything except access to women who were defenseless. But nevertheless, you had a historian, Tannenbaum, arguing that there was a great deal of miscegenation, he said, in Latin America. I'm not even sure if he was correct in suggesting that there was more miscegenation in Brazil, say, than in the southern United States. And his very premise, I'm not sure if it was correct. I doubt very much whether there could have been more miscegenation in Brazil or Cuba or someplace like that than there was in New Orleans or Charleston, South Carolina. Maybe here in Hebron, Kentucky, who knows? I don't know much about Kentucky. Nevertheless, I mention this again just to give you a sort of a sense of how controversial a thing this question of slavery has been and will continue to be. This brings me to the role of Jews in the African slave trade. I have been a teacher of black history for many years, 30 or more years. And of course, as a teacher of black history, one obviously has to be acquainted with the question of slavery and the slave trade. I never really considered myself a great specialist in the slave trade per se, even though I was acquainted with it in a general way. But of course, circumstances conspired to cause me to look closely at this aspect of black history, especially the question of Jews in the African slave trade. Now, the question of Jews in the African slave trade is one which I, despite the fact that I was a professor of African history for many years, is a question that I was only dimly aware of. I had come across a little reference someplace suggesting that there was a Jewish presence in the African slave trade. But now that I am more aware of the role that Jews played, it strikes me as very interesting that I could have taught African history and black history generally, African-American history, Caribbean history for so long without having a clearer sense of the involvement of Jews in that nefarious trade. And it seems to me that as I look back on this reality, it seems to me that somewhere along the line, there must have been perhaps a deliberate tendency on the part of somebody, I'm not sure who, maybe book publishers, maybe historians themselves, but it seems as though there was a tendency over the years to downplay, to deliberately downplay and to obscure, to camouflage the role of Jews in the African slave trade. Now I realize that many of the people who I now know to have been Jews, who played an important role in the slave trade, were described in history books as just white or Portuguese or Spaniards or whatever. There was a tendency, and there still is a tendency, whenever Jews were involved, if it was something concerning which Jews were proud, then that person would be identified as a Jew. if it was something that concerning which Jews maybe felt that, you know, that it might cause a bad reflection on that kind, there was a tendency to sort of hide behind other people. So that Jewish racism would become white racism, or Jewish involvement in the slave trade would become Portuguese involvement, and so on. I had a very graphic demonstration of this shortly after my controversy arose, when that Sunday morning program, The Week with David Brinkley, I think it's an ABC TV program, I believe. Well, you know, one of the more prestigious Sunday morning talk programs. David Brinkley, I suppose, is considered a very authoritative figure. But amazingly to me, the question of the Jewish involvement in the slave trade was considered so important by these folks in the major media that they actually spent a segment one morning on The Week with David Brinkley. This is around about 1994, I think, discussing me and the whole question of the Jewish involvement in the African slave trade. And David Brinkley, and I, in my book, The Jewish Onslaught, I refer to this incident, and I refer to David Brinkley as speaking with the authority of the blissfully ignorant. And David Brinkley, with great authority, announced that Jews had nothing to do with the slave trade. He said, the Portuguese, yes, but not the Jews. You know, he said, Professor Martin at Wellesley College is insane, you know, and Cokie Roberts said, oh, they should boycott his classes, he should be fired, and all kinds of things for saying that Jews were involved in the slave trade. But come to find out that many of these Portuguese that are, in fact, perhaps the majority of these Portuguese, you know, slave ship owners and so on, that David Brinkley was talking about were, in fact, Jews. Some were what they called Moranos, Jews who pretended to convert to Christianity, then declared their Jewishness at the first opportunity and so on. But here was just one of many examples where the Jewish presence in this trade tended to be camouflaged, you know, under other kinds of categorizations. So then I was just very, only dimly aware then of this whole question of the Jewish involvement in the slave trade, until sometime around 1992 or thereabouts, I received a little postcard in the mail. It was a bulk mailing advertising a book published by the Nation of Islam's Historical Research Department. The book was entitled The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews. And I ordered the book and I read it. I was very impressed by it. And as a good professor, you know, I always try, despite the fact that I've taught for many years, but I always try to keep my students abreast of latest developments. So here was something that fascinated me, something that surprised me since I had been unaware of it. And I did what I always do in that situation, and that is I decided to incorporate some of this new information in my African-American survey history class. I actually used the book in a Caribbean history class for one semester without incident. I used it in the following semester in an African-American history class, and that's when, as the saying goes, all hell broke loose. But before I describe what happened, let me spend a few minutes summarizing the facts of Jewish involvement in the slave trade. What precisely was the nature of the Jewish involvement in the African slave trade? The Jewish involvement in the African slave trade begins, as far as I can tell, long before the actual slave trade across the Atlantic itself. The transatlantic slave trade has its immediate origins around about 1441, when Portuguese sailors landed on the West African coast and kidnapped a few Africans, brought them back to Europe. Africans were brought back to Europe, to Portugal and to Spain as part of that particular trade for several years. Columbus, of course, arrived in the Americas in 1492, approximately half a century later. In 1502, the first Africans were brought to the Caribbean. The Caribbean is where the transatlantic slave trade begins, and many Americans don't know that. But for over 100 years before Africans were brought as slaves to this country, the United States of America, Africans were being brought across the Atlantic to the Caribbean, to places like Hispaniola, the island which today is shared by Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and to other places as well. So it seems to me that Jewish involvement then in that transatlantic slave trade precedes by many, many years, perhaps by 1,000 years, the actual beginnings of the transatlantic slave trade. And let me explain. It seems to me that the most important theoretical underpinning for that transatlantic slave trade was what has come to be known in many quarters of the Hamitic myth. Some people call it the curse of Ham's story. When the slave trade developed, beginning in 1441 and for hundreds of years thereafter, people who prosecuted that trade looked around for intellectual justification, for rationalizations, for pretexts, if you will. And a variety of pretexts were advanced to justify the slave trade, to allow people to sleep well at night, you know, for their consciences to be clear. One justification was that Africans were heathens. They weren't Christian, they were heathens, and therefore it was all right to enslave heathens. It would not be all right to enslave one's Christian brother, but it would be okay. It would be morally justifiable to enslave a heathen. That was one kind of rationale that was an advance to justify the slave trade. Another rationale was that Africans were less than human. Africans were devoid of reason, could not reason, were a subspecies of creature. They weren't human. And therefore, again, whereas there might have been some moral opprobrium attached to enslaving one's fellow human beings, in the case of Africans, since they weren't quite human, that kind of treatment of Africans was okay. The most important, however, of all of these rationales that was advanced to try to justify the slave trade was the question of this Hamitic myth. That is, the notion that Africans were cursed by God himself, that Africans had been cursed by God, that God had decreed in his wisdom a very long time ago that Africans would be forever the hewers of wood and the drawers of water for other races. The authority for this idea was said to reside in the book of Genesis, in a story in the book of Genesis. Now, there's a story in the book of Genesis, and there's an interpretation of that story that allowed it to be used to justify African slavery, and they're two different things. The story in Genesis is in Genesis. It's been in the Bible ever since. But the sort of spin that was put on that story that enabled it to become the basis for the Hamitic myth actually comes out of the Talmud, the Jewish holy book, the Talmud, somewhere around 500 AD or thereabouts, the Babylonian Talmud. Let me just describe the difference between the story as it appears in the Bible and the story as it was spun in the Talmud. According to the Bible, Noah, after the flood, apparently had a vineyard someplace, and he partook of the wine that was produced out of his vineyard. He got himself drunk one night, went into his tent, took his clothes off, as people often do when they get drunk. And according to the biblical story, he had three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. Ham apparently entered the area where his father was lying in his drunken, naked stupor, and Ham, in an act of disrespect, gazed upon his father's nakedness and apparently went back outside and informed his two other brothers of his father's condition. According to the biblical story, the two other brothers then came inside the tent or wherever, and out of respect for their father, they kind of backed into the tent. They would not look directly at him in his naked condition. They backed into the tent, they covered him with some kind of a garment. And according to the biblical story, when Noah revived, when he, you know, arose from his drunken stupor and realized what had happened, he then cursed Ham's son Canaan and all of his descendants forever, and said that they would be the servants of the descendants of the other two brothers, Shem and Japheth. Somewhere along the line, I'm not quite sure how come, but somewhere along the line, somebody came up with the notion that Ham was the progenitor of the African race, and Shem was the progenitor of the Asian race, and Japheth was the progenitor of the European race. So Noah had three sons of three different races, and he cursed his African son and their descendants and said that those descendants would be the slaves, the servants of the Asian branch of the family, and also the European branch of the family forever. And that's as far as the biblical story goes. The Talmud, which of course, my understanding of the Talmud, I'm no expert on the Talmud, but my understanding is that the Talmud consists of interpretations, what they call glosses, on various biblical stories. And these glosses or interpretations or spins are supposed to give people who subscribe to the Judaic religion a sort of an authoritative guide as to how to interpret the biblical stories and whatnot. So what the Talmud did then, the Talmud came along, the Babylonian Talmud, around about 500 or so AD, and proceeded to spin this biblical story, and for reasons that are unknown to me. But Ham, again, was said to be the progenitor of the African race. Now, interestingly enough, I read someplace that early Christians also accepted this notion of Ham being some sort of progenitor of the African race. But apparently, in the Christian tradition, the kind of, you know, overtly racist implications of that fact didn't develop in the same way as it developed in the Judaic tradition. According to the Talmud, Ham was the original African, and when God, through Noah, cursed Ham and his son Canaan and all his descendants, he was in fact cursing the African race. Now, this was the unique new element to the story that the Talmud originated, that the curse on Ham and Canaan was not only a curse on an individual and his family, but it was a curse on a race. So here, this is the contribution then of the Talmud, that God, through Noah, cursed the African race. And the Talmud proceeded to embellish the story in the most delightful, should I say, ways. For example, the Talmud said that there was ample proof that God was in fact cursing the African race. It said, for example, that because Ham had gazed upon Noah's nakedness in the dark of night, that the African race was henceforth turned black, so that the blackness of the African became a sort of a visible indication of that curse. The Talmud said that because it was dark at night when Ham entered that tent and looked upon his father's nakedness, he had to open his eyes, he had to buck his eyes, as they say in America, to see his father in the darkness. And that's why Africans had big eyes. The Talmud said, and here, and I'm going to quote all this exactly in a minute. You know, I'm not making this up. It sounds incredible, but I'm actually paraphrasing a gentleman by the name of Harold Brackman, a man who worked until recently for the Simon Wiesenthal Center of all agencies. He wrote all of this in his dissertation. And it might not surprise you to discover that once people like myself began quoting what this guy Brackman wrote, I'm sure you can guess what happened next. And that is that Brackman denied he had ever written this stuff. This stuff is in Brackman's PhD dissertation. It's called The Ebb and Flow of History. Anybody here can easily read it. You can get it in any library. If they don't have it, they'll get it for you interlibrary loans. It's called The Ebb and Flow of History. It's a PhD dissertation, I think in the history department at UCLA, 1977, by Harold D. Brackman, who I believe up to a couple of years ago, maybe even now, is or was until recently a functionary of the Simon Wiesenthal, or is it Wiesenthal Center. But despite the fact that his writings were clearly in the public record, that anybody, an undergrad student, can access this stuff and check it for themselves, once the story got out, he quickly denied it ever written this. This man actually wrote letters to the New York Times. I believe I have the actual footnotes here in the Jewish Onslaught concerning all this. This man wrote letters to the New York Times. He wrote a slew of letters to black publications all over this country, denying all of this stuff, even though it's right there on the record. So I'm using very good evidence here when I paraphrase what he's saying. Brackman tells us that because, and here it gets to be totally hilarious. Now, these Jewish rabbis, the sages, they call them, the wise men who put together this Talmud, they actually invented, they sort of elaborated on the biblical story. You know, it's like a jazz musician who improvises. Yeah. Well, they improvise on the story. They did a whole elaborate improvisation in the story. And somehow, Lord knows how come, but they came up with the notion that Ham, when he went into that tent and looked upon his naked father, Noah, that Ham buggered his father. He had anal intercourse with his father. And because he had anal intercourse with his father, that's the reason And here I'm citing Blackmun. That's the reason why part of the curse was to give black men large sexual organs. So all of this was part of the curse. The black skin, the big eyes, even the kinky hair too, big sexual organs, all of this. So as amazing as this may seem, this transpired 1,000 years before the beginnings of the transatlantic slave trade. And when the slave trade came into being, this notion of the Hamitic curse was revived, and it became, both for Jews and for Christians, it became the most pervasive of all the attempts to rationalize that slave trade. Let me quote the exact words of Harold Blackmun, lest you suspect that I'm making this up. I'm quoting here from Harold Blackmun, the dissertation I mentioned a minute ago, The Ebb and Flow of History. Quote, there is no denying, this is on page 34 in case anybody who has a book feels like reading along with me. I know several of you have the book out there. But this is on page 34 in the middle of the page, second new paragraph. There is no denying that the Babylonian Talmud was the first source, and listen to how unequivocal he is here. It was the first, the very first. In other words, this is Blackmun from the Simon Wiesenthal Center acknowledging that the Talmud was the one, was the place that invented the story of the Hamitic curse. There is no denying that the Babylonian Talmud was the first source to read a negrophobic content into the episode. Here he is referring to the episode of Ham looking upon his father's nakedness. He goes on to suggest that these early sages, some of them, you know, imposed this homosexual spin onto the story. Quote, he says, Rab is one of these sages. He says, Rab maintained that Ham had unmanned Noah. So Ham, according to this sage, had actually castrated his father. While Samuel is some other sage, Samuel claimed that he had buggered him as well, both unmanned him and buggered him. Now, how this arose out of the biblical story, I'll never understand. Let me continue to quote from Blackmun here in his dissertation. Quote, he is discussing here various, slightly diverging, variants of this myth. He goes on to say, quote, the more important version of the myth, that's the Hamitic myth, however, ingeniously ties in the origins of blackness and of other real and imagined negroid traits with Noah's curse itself. According to it, that's according to this most popular version of the Hamitic myth. According to it, Ham is told by his outraged father that because you have abused me in the darkness of the night, your children shall be born black and ugly. This is in the Talmud. Because you have twisted your head to cause me embarrassment, they shall have kinky hair and red eyes. So if you ever wondered about the origin of the kinky hair and the red eyes of black folk, here you have it. Because your lips jested at my exposure, theirs shall swell. That's why black folks have thick lips. And because you neglected my nakedness, they, that is your children, the children of Ham and Canaan, they shall go naked with their shamefully elongated male members exposed for all to see. So there you have the origin of a whole variety of stereotypes pertaining to African folk. So the Hamitic myth then is where you really have to begin, in terms of a discussion of the Jewish role in the slave trade. They provided the rationale par excellence for the prosecution of that slave trade. Some years after the Babylonian Talmud, sometime in the Middle Ages, a man who I believe they consider to be perhaps one of the greatest philosophers ever, a man by the name of Maimonides, actually also contributed to that notion of Africans being subhuman when in his famous book, Guide to the Perplexed, when he, Maimonides, suggested again that African people were less than human, but they were somewhere between monkeys and human beings. This is Maimonides, a man who is one of the most revered of all of these Jewish sages. So by the time then that the slave trade came along, then, you know, there was this tradition which had been floating around Europe, and it was seized upon then by the slave traders, Jews and Gentiles alike, as a basic rationale. There were other areas, you know, in which the Jewish presence was very manifest. For example, although I don't know a whole lot about this aspect of it, but my understanding is that Jews were in fact very prominent as slave traders, you know, in the centuries prior to the beginning of the Atlantic slave trade. My understanding is that Jews, you know, for many years sold Muslim slaves to Christians and sold Christian slaves to Muslims, and they were sort of accepted as the slave middlemen by both sides. And this is, you know, a long time before the Atlantic slave trade came about. The earliest multinational corporation involved in the Atlantic slave trade was something called a Dutch West India Company. And again, it often surprises people to discover that even in this early period, you know, globalization was already a very fairly entrenched phenomenon. The slave trade was a great example of globalization. Here you had the Dutch West India Company, out of Holland, of course, which went to West Africa. They had their own private army. They established forts on the West African coast. They had their own fleet of ships and so on. They had their own administrators. Sometimes they would govern areas. They had their own governors, administrators, and whatnot. They were almost like, it was almost like colonization, via private enterprise. It was like privatized colonization. And all of this, of course, transpired with the sanction of European governments. These were like surrogate governments almost, these chartered companies, as they were often called. So the Dutch West India Company in the 1600s then was the pioneer in this kind of multinational, globalized prosecution of the slave trade. And apparently a large number of the shareholders, the stockholders in this Dutch West India Company were Jews. The Jews had been chased out of Portugal and Spain. They had been chased out of all kinds of places. They found some respite from their wanderings in Holland. They became an influential factor in Holland. And I've seen a variety of figures. This too is an area of some controversy. I've seen estimates varying from 25% to 50% concerning the stake of Jewish stockholders in the Dutch West India Company. But suffice it to say that they were an important element in the Dutch West India Company, which was the preeminent entity carrying on the slave trade in the early period. The Dutch West India Company was responsible for importing, you know, the earliest slaves to places like Brazil, to some parts of the Caribbean, either directly or indirectly, I think, to this country as well in a very early period in the 17th century. In many areas in the Americas, Jews were a dominant element in the slave trade. In Brazil, for example, in the 17th century, Jews were a dominant element in the slave trade. They owned a large number of the plantations. They were often very importantly positioned in other aspects, not necessarily the plantation aspects, but things like, say, the importation of slaves, things like the warehousing of slaves, things like the auctioning of slaves, things like the provisioning of slaves, things like manning slave ships, provisioning slave ships. In New England, for example, at the height of the Atlantic slave trade, rum became a major economic venture in New England, places like Providence, Rhode Island, places like Boston and so on. And rum was a major factor in the slave trade because rum was one of the major items of trade, one of the major items that, you know, slave ships carried when they went to West Africa to trade and exchange for slaves and so on. And I believe that at one point all the rum distilleries in Boston were owned by Jews. I think there was something like 18 or something like that rum distilleries. So in all of these areas, both directly and in terms of ancillary industries feeding the slave trade, Jews were very, very important. Apart from Brazil, Jews were again dominant factors in many other parts of the area. For example, in Curacao, a Dutch island in the Caribbean, you know, the majority of folks involved in the slave trade in Curacao were Jews. At one point in Suriname, which again was a Dutch colony right next to Brazil in South America, Jews were again a very important part of the slave trade in Suriname. There was an English soldier by the name of John Steadman who went to Suriname in the late 1700s as part of a mercenary force raised by the Dutch to try to fight against the Maroon slaves. Those were the escaped slaves who established an independent existence in the interior and gave the slave regime a lot of trouble. And Steadman wrote a very fascinating book concerning his experiences in Suriname. And there are several references in Steadman's book to the presence of Jewish slave owners and so on. There was one large plantation area in Suriname called Jew Savannah. Jew Savannah. And according to Steadman, the Jews were very often the most cruel of the slave owners. They played a very prominent role in torturing slaves and so on. He has several little vignettes that he mentions in there concerning the kind of cruelties that were meted out to slaves by both Jewish men and women. There's one case he describes there of a Maroon slave leader, a man called Joli Coeur, French Joli Coeur. Beautiful heart, don't know where he got that name from, Joli Coeur. But apparently Joli Coeur, again, was a rebellious slave. He led a slave uprising. And on one occasion, apparently, the Maroons were fighting against, you know, some of these people from Jew Savannah. And according to Steadman, they captured a Jewish slave owner named Schultz. And apparently Schultz was the man that Joli Coeur, you know, the slave owner that Joli Coeur had escaped from as a young boy. And Joli Coeur remembered that this guy Schultz had apparently ravaged his mother and so on. And Steadman describes a very, very, very harsh vengeance that was wrought by Joli Coeur on Schultz. He flayed him, cut his skin off, then used his skin to keep the powder dry, the powder for his cannon or whatever, and used his head to play football with. Jews were also very prominently present in non-Dutch parts of the Caribbean, places like Barbados, places like Jamaica, St. Thomas, and many of the other islands as well. That has arisen concerning, you know, whether Jews were the dominant element or not, or whether they were even an important element. But much of that discussion has taken place in the context of the United States of America. In the U.S., it may not be correct to say that slaves were as dominant in the slave trade as they were in parts of, say, the Caribbean or Central America. Nevertheless, Jews were an important part of the slave trade in this country, in the U.S. of A. Anyway, in fact, in the U.S. of A., Jews apparently played a role in the slave trade that was greater than the numbers in the overall population would suggest. Just as in 1992, a study done based on the Forbes magazine list of the richest people in America for 1992, a study based on that list discovered that something like 33% of the billionaires in the US of A were Jews, based on the Forbes list of 1992, at a time when Jews claimed to be 2.5% of the United States population. So just as in 1992, they were overrepresented in the high echelons of this country, just so during the slave trade, even though their numbers may have been relatively small, and many of the people who have tried to refute, you know, the suggestion that Jews were prominently involved in the slave trade in this country, many of those people have put forward figures suggesting that Jews were only a very minute portion of the overall American population. Yes, they were a very small percentage of the American population, but that has nothing to do with their role in the slave trade, the importance of their role. Their role was much greater than their numbers in the overall population would suggest. As a matter of fact, a Jewish historian has done a study of the 1830 census in the South and has come up with the conclusion that something like 75% of Jewish households in the South in this country in 1830 owned slaves, whereas the percentage for white households generally was only something like 36%. So the Jews were approximately twice as likely as non-Jews, as the white population, to own slaves in this country in the South in 1830. So again, we're talking here about, you know, proportions rather than absolute figures. Some of the most important slave ship owners in colonial America were Jews. You know, perhaps the best known of these is a man called Aaron Lopez. I noticed that many of these persons had Spanish or Portuguese sounding last names, and that's because they were Sephardic Jews. When this whole question arose, you know, around my involvement in all this, many Jews were heard to say that there were no Jews in America prior to the 1880s. In fact, Nathan Glaser, a very famous academic out of Harvard University, who should know better, he actually wrote that there's no way that Jews could be responsible for the slave trade in America, since there were no Jews here, he said, before 1880. Of course, there were European Jews here in the 19th century before 1880, German Jews and so on. But there were Sephardic Jews here from the very beginning, you know, from the 17th century, there were Sephardic Jews coming in here to New York and later to other places. So hence the Spanish-sounding names, names like Nunez, names like Lopez, names like Castro, interestingly enough, names like Ferreira, Herrera, Gomes, Gomez. All of these names, interestingly enough, suggested Jewish origin in colonial times. As somebody was saying to me yesterday, you could usually get a hint of their Jewishness from their first names. The last name might be Gomez or Nunez or Castro, but the first name might be Jacob or David or something like that, Aaron. So Aaron Lopez was out of Newport, Rhode Island. He was one of the largest slave ship owners in colonial America. This man had a fleet of ships for many years. He sent his ships to West Africa. They traveled from West Africa to the Caribbean, to Barbados, to Jamaica, St. Thomas, places like that. He had members of his family situated in the Caribbean. He had a whole network going on, and he brought slaves back here as well. Many of his slaves helped to build some famous synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island in colonial times. Despite the fact that, oh, by the way, Jews were also involved in other aspects of the trade. My time is running out, so I'm going to be quick here. For example, they were involved, again, in provisioning slaves here in this country, as they were in other areas as well, you know, providing the kind of coarse cloth that slaves wore, things like that. They had a hand in providing the kinds of restraints and handcuffs and chains and padlocks and those kinds of things that were used to sort of enforce servitude of the Africans as well. Interestingly enough, despite the prominence of Jews in this African slave trade in this country, in the US of A, their prominence in the African slave trade was not matched by a similar prominence in the abolitionist movement. In fact, some of the Christian abolitionists noted this apparent contradiction. In fact, let me quote you here a very interesting statement put out by Christian abolitionists. This is 1853. It's from the American and Foreign Anti-Slavery Society report, 1853. Quote, "The Jews of the United States have never taken any steps, whatever, with regard to the slavery question. As citizens, they deem it their policy to have everyone choose whichever side he may deem best to promote his own interests and the welfare of his country," et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This statement concludes as follows, quote, "The objects of so much mean prejudice and unrighteous oppression as the Jews have been for ages, surely they, it would seem, more than any other denomination, ought to be the enemies of caste and friends of universal freedom." Such, however, was not the case. There were very few and far between as far as the abolitionist movement was concerned. So this then is the reality of Jewish involvement in the slave trade. And that's the reality that I faced then in 1993 when I stumbled into this controversy simply by exposing my students to the fact that Jews, like everybody else, had been involved. And of course, I did not deny the involvement of anybody else. I did not even deny the involvement of African collaborators. You know, for years I had taught Christian involvement, and up to now I am still somewhat surprised that everybody else, you know, seems willing to acknowledge their involvement in the trade. But for some reason, this is the only group that not only refuses to acknowledge the involvement, but becomes, you know, very, 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 very upset when that involvement is mentioned. I won't have time to go into my particular situation. It's all here in the Jewish onslaught. I'll just say very briefly before I wrap up, I was just told I have about 3 more minutes left. But this controversy assumed enormous proportions. I'm still surprised. You know, here was something as simple as my teaching this information, which is all well documented. The book that I was using, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, put out by the Nation of Islam, that book relies almost 100% on Jewish sources. But what is interesting, though, is that even though the Jewish academics and authoritative sources like the Encyclopedia, Judaica, even though these sort of academic, esoteric Jewish sources were quite forthcoming in acknowledging their role in the slave trade, the popular Jewish press and the popular Jewish populace, I guess, many of them were either unaware of all of this or refused to believe it. I remember some Jewish alumni writing into the to the Wellesley College alumni magazine, suggesting that my teaching, you know, the Jewish involvement in the slave trade, was akin to suspending the rules of grammar in an English class. The end result of all this is that the role of Jews in the slave trade, something which was unknown to many folks prior to 1993, something which was largely unknown to me because of the hullabaloo created by the Jewish media and so on, I think that has, in a sense, had an effect that they perhaps did not anticipate. And that is that something which was in fact a secret relationship is no longer secret. The whole world is now aware of the fact, thanks to the hullabaloo created by the Jewish media, of the Jewish involvement in the slave trade. And even though there has been an incredible effort since 1993 to, on the part of the Jewish media to sort of counterattack. For example, the Amistad movie was part of that counterattack. The Amistad movie very subtly suggested that Africans were the ones responsible for their own enslavement. The Amistad movie, you know, put out by Steven Spielberg, actually had an African slave. Imagine this. Steven Spielberg actually had an African slave in the Amistad movie saying, I did not see the movie, by the way, I refused to see it, but I was told that Spielberg actually had an African slave in this movie saying that he was so sorry for the great suffering that, you know, the Jews had gone through, you know, and whatnot, and that nobody in the world, this was an African slave, a man who was on death row, in jail, fighting for his life as an African slave. And Spielberg has this man saying that he had just read the Bible and these folks had suffered so much, etc., etc. Nobody in the world had suffered as much as they had. The whole question of late of an alleged slave trade in the Sudan. Now, there may indeed be a Muslim slave trade in the Sudan. There may, I know, it doesn't, you know, bother me one way or the other. But the whole attempt to elevate this into a new great anti-slavery crusade, that too is one of the means by which the Jewish establishment has tried to kind of cover up, you know, their own involvement in the slave trade. I don't know how many books on the slave trade have been published by Jews in the last 6-7 years. I have lost count, but it could easily be a dozen. You know, that they keep just churning out these books. But the more noise they make, the more people become aware of the fact that, you know, that there is a Jewish involvement in the slave trade. So I think that, to that extent, I think they have kind of shot themselves in the foot this time around. They have let the genie out of the bottle. Available have come from Jewish sources themselves. For example, the statistic I mentioned about something like 75% of Jewish households in the South having slaves, as opposed to 36% of white households. That comes from a Jewish historian, and he went back to the census and he did the kinds of things that you were hinting at. Now, even for a Jewish historian, as you mentioned yesterday, the Jews themselves aren't sure what a Jew is and who is a Jew. But insofar as he could plausibly ascertain, you know, from names and from other kinds of evidence, yes. But of course, there was no way he could be 100% certain. let's see.
Better to be 30 years in the trying to go out and say that the times are behind us, you would never do it again.
Yes, I think that would have been the most sensible thing to do. Acknowledge it the same way that everybody else has done, and let's move on. But by trying to create an issue about it, I think they forced themselves into an indefensible position.
The Jewish community representative, do you have an idea of the percentage of slaves that were imported to America versus Brazil, South America, Caribbean, et cetera? I've heard that of the entire slave trade, that America itself only got a very low percentage.
I'm not sure if North America got a low percentage, but I think it's generally acknowledged that Brazil was the place that absorbed the majority of the Africans. And I believe up to today, I think Brazil actually has the largest African population of any place in the Americas. In fact, some people argue that Brazil has the second largest African population of any country in the world after Nigeria. Of course, there's a great complexity around racial, designations in Brazil.
We can't only blame the Jews. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In other words, nothing was done about it.
Well, I don't think anybody has ever attempted to blame only the Jews. I certainly have never attempted to blame only the Jews. My position all along has been that other groups have acknowledged their involvement. So what is so special about the Jews that that they are beyond academic inquiry? That has been my position. Of course, many of the Jewish people have accused people like myself of arguing that the Jews were exclusively responsible for the trade. Because what they have tended to do, because their position is so indefensible, what they tend to do is to ascribe to people like myself, a totally off-the-wall position. In other words, they create a man of straw, then they attack that man of straw. But that man of straw is saying things that I never said. For example, they claim that people like myself were suggesting the Jews were genetically predisposed towards enslavement, but I never said anything like that. But they find it much more comfortable to attack what they claim you say than what you actually said.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.